Welcome to Fill the Gap, the official podcast series of the CMT Association, hosted by David Lundgren and Tyler Wood. This monthly podcast will bring veteran market analysts and money managers into conversations that will explore the interviewee's investment philosophy, their process, and decision-making tools. By learning more about their key mentors, early influences, and their long careers in financial services, Fill the Gap will highlight lessons our guests have learned over many decades and multiple market cycles. Join us in conversation with the men and women of Wall Street who discovered, engineered, and refined the discipline of technical market analysis.
Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima, a professional charting and data analytics platform. Whether you're a professional analyst, portfolio manager, or trader, Optima provides advanced technical and quantitative software to help you discover financial opportunities. Candidates in the CMT program gain free access to these powerful tools during the course of their study. Learn more at optima.com.
Good afternoon, David Lundgren, and welcome to this Valentine's Day episode of Fill the Gap, episode number 26, with our featured guest, Vernon Bice from Lord Abbott. How are you doing today, Dave?
Well, I'm doing especially well now that you reminded me it's Valentine's Day. I got to go get that dinner reservation. Thank you very much. Love you.
Dinner reservations on Valentine's Day are for youngsters, people who don't know better. The veteran move is to take her out on Monday night ahead of Valentine's Day. We had a beautiful dinner last night, Dave.
Well, take her out at 4:30.
What are you, 80? Oh, Dave, it is such a pleasure to get into these conversations every month with you and our special guests. I feel like a lot of the topics, a lot of the questions that we ask our guests are pretty familiar to listeners over time. We're talking about tools and process. We're talking about approaches to money management. But every single guest has these unique nuggets and different ways that they employ technical analysis. For you in this interview, what really stood out about Vern's take on the markets?
Well, I mean, what I really like about Vern, because it really dovetails with how I think about things, is that he just doesn't complicate things. He doesn't get into the weeds of the many tools that that we can really bring to bear in our decision making. But I think the reason he does that is because he knows his audience, and he works with Tom O'Halloran, who's a legendary growth investor, and who really respects the value of charts and trend following and the message of the market, what the market has to say and what the market's thinking. And so he really leans heavily on Vern to help him decipher the message of the market and try to isolate where the opportunities are, where the risks are. And I think in order to be able to, as a technician, to be able to bridge that gap or fill that gap with a fundamentally minded investor, you really do need to just, you know, keep it simple. And you should do that anyway. First principles, Ralph Acampora, John Bollinger talks about that all the time. And so he just does a really great job of doing that. And his story is phenomenal. I won't get into his story. I'll wait I'll let the listeners hear Vern tell it firsthand, because it is such a great story. He is such a great guy, and we're so fortunate to have him in our community.
Absolutely. Yeah. The story you're referring to and his path into finance is certainly atypical, certainly was not born into the roles that he has. And he treats that with the respect that hopefully all of us in financial services could bring to bear, some humility and some appreciation for what is truly a really fun way to work. It's creative and it's dynamic, and you never get bored, and you get to meet incredible mentors and people throughout the industry. I think the CMT Association is a great catalyst for that. And Vern certainly has shared a lot of really kind comments of appreciation for being welcomed into this community. But I think that that openness and that flexibility, it's not just amongst the members of the community, but also in how we approach money management. And I think for me, that that comment about being flexible, about being able to divorce yourself from an opinion, even if it's very fully formed from a fundamental thesis or any other discipline, but to really be able to pivot when the market disagrees with you. I think those are some really evergreen lessons. And hopefully our listeners enjoy this episode, number 26 of Fill the Gap, with our guest, Vernon Bice, CMT.
My name is Brett Viom, and I'm the president of the CMT Association. I would like to personally invite you to attend the CMT's 50th Anniversary Symposium this April 26th, 27th, and 28th in New York City. Each year, we bring together the top minds in the field of technical market analysis to present their methodologies, current outlooks on financial markets, and lessons learned. Asset managers, traders, advisors, and analysts have the opportunity to meet and discuss ideas at what many have called the most open and engaging financial conference of their careers. This year's symposium aims to be our best yet as we celebrate our 50th year of being the global standard in technical analysis research and education. Enjoy cocktails and conversation at the fabled New York Stock Exchange. Meet the living legends of technical analysis, such as Ralph Acampora, Ned Davis, Tom DeMarc, and many more. If you're interested in leveraging this world-class event to get your company's thought leadership and brand identity center stage, customizable corporate sponsorship opportunities are still available. Visit our website at cmtassociation.org to register now.
Welcome to Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association. My name is Dave Lundgren, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host and fellow CMT charter holder, Tyler Wood. In episode 26, we have the great privilege of discussing all things technical with another fellow CMT charter holder, Vern Bice. Vern is a member of the Innovation Growth Equity Team over at Lord Abbett, where he plays a key role in providing the growth team with comprehensive technical analysis of the broader markets, as well as the individual holdings within the portfolios they manage. Now, over the years, I've actually had the great fortune of spending a lot of time with Tom O'Halloran, who skiing with him out west in Jeff DeGraff's place out in Colorado. And of course, Tom is the lead PM of the growth team over at Lord Abbett. And I got to tell you, it was tough keeping up with him on the slopes, but it was even more impossible keeping up with him during our chart discussions during après-ski. The guy is a voracious consumer of technical analysis, so I cannot wait to get Vern's take on what it's like to work with somebody like Tom O'Halloran as the lead technician on his growth team. It's a storied, very successful premier fundamental growth team in the business. And Vern works directly with him, and he's been there for about 11 or so years. So I can't wait to get his take on it. So let's jump right in. Vern, welcome to Fill the Gap.
Thanks, Dave. And it's great to see you and Tyler again.
Yeah. Good to see you too, Vern.
So we usually like to start off with just a quick introduction, allow you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. But if you can also try to give us some insight as to what got you to embrace the idea of technicals and then get your CMT charter through the course of your career.
Sure. And thanks again for the great introduction there, Dave. And you're right. I find myself very blessed to work with a legend, Tom O'Halloran. And I also get to work with a great team. Matt DeSico has been with Tom almost 20 years, I believe now. He is now the head of equity over at Lord Abbett and a co-manager on all of our strategies. I get to work with folks like Ben Abel, who's our technical expert, and Steve Wortman, who's an expert in consumer, and Samantha Shevins, who's an expert in biotech. We've got a host of really, really great people that I get to work with. And I'm very fortunate to be in this business and work at a firm and for a boss that embraces technicals and fundamentals. And so how did I get into all this? You know, you and I have talked about this in the past, and it was pure luck. And, you know, maybe a little bit of hard work, but a lot of luck. And I didn't exactly have a traditional path getting into doing what I'm doing. I started out from humble means. I grew up in the tri-state area of Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. A beautiful place to grow up, but very far removed from Wall Street. Yeah. And so I didn't know a ton about Wall Street. I, like I said, come from kind of humble beginnings in terms of, you know, my family. I was maybe the first to go to college and that sort of thing. So I didn't have a lot of direction at first. So I found myself, a couple things happened. You know, my mother always instilled in me the value of education, as did my great grandmother. I was very fortunate to know three of my great grandparents. If that's, wow, you know, in this day and age, that's pretty rare. So what I lacked in some monetary means, it was sure made up for in my family and the love they had for me and pushing me towards getting educated, because they didn't necessarily have that privilege. You know, it was a different time back then in that area, especially a lot of folks in my family would talk about the Depression and that sort of thing. So it just gave me a really strong sense of and an appreciation for education. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very fortunate that, you know, in high school, my stepfather, my mom remarried. My father actually passed away when I was very young. And, you know, that was not a great event. But like I said, we had a great family to come in and take care of the family and really show the support we needed. And then my mom remarried a great gentleman that happened to read Investor's Business Daily religiously.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that funny?
That's awesome.
And so I, you know, he had a small produce business in Huntington, West Virginia. And he let me start working for him, keeping the books, making deliveries of fruits and vegetables, you know, in the van. And when I was in high school, I was just, this is great. And he always had that IBD. There was like stacks of them next to the produce boxes. They are littered everywhere. I'm like, gosh, get these things away. What are these things? And so I asked him one day and he says, you know, this is the idea that you can invest in businesses and make money from the money you invest. And you look at charts to find patterns. And you look at the fundamentals to make sure that they're doing the right thing, selling the right products and services, and you can make money by just using money. I'm like, this is insane. I love this already.
Love it.
But the problem was I didn't have any money. Yeah. So anyway, I eventually started saving some money and opened a brokerage account. And, you know, this is in the 90s and when everyone was opening in a brokerage account. And started, you know, but this was the early part of the 90s, actually, in the mid 90s. And then, you know, I started trying to invest along with my stepfather, and he really kind of showed me the ropes. And then I started reading anything I could. First book was probably How to Make Money in Stocks by Bill O'Neill, mm-hmm. which I still consider the growth Bible. Mm-hmm. And I Market Wizards, a lot of the books that I've heard being mentioned on the podcast so far since I've been listening to y'all. And so I just got bit by the bug, but it took a bit of a detour. I went to college, didn't realize that I could work on Wall Street. It just seemed so far removed. Mm-hmm. And found myself getting into med school. And for a year, I was in med school for a year. And then I had this guidance counselor from New York who noticed that, once again, I was carrying around IBD, talking to all my classmates about stocks and that sort of thing. He says, why didn't you move to New York and work on in finance? And I said, I don't know. I didn't know anyone. I have no connections. And he goes, well, you can do it. You could have done it if you wanted to. And I said, well, maybe I still can. And then about a month later, I went into the dean and dropped out to her dismay and horror. packed a bag and I moved to New York. And that started me working my way up. You know, the first job I took was in Bank of America mm-hmm. as a temp. I happened to work for a very famous strategist there at the time and started meeting some really cool people and just started navigating my way through the halls of Wall Street. I would do anything anyone asked. I didn't care if it was getting lunch, picking up dry cleaning, staying late. I just wanted to learn because I was behind, you know, and I think that enthusiasm helped me a lot, you know, and people picked up on that, took me under their wing, so to speak. But it took a long time to get to what my dream was of being a long only growth investor. And that happened when I started working for John Louie over at Bank of New York and small cap growth fund, just by luck. I was in asset management for the first few years of my career, which really taught me the ropes. So I had some great bosses that really gave me a broad understanding of bonds, stocks, different asset classes, and that sort of thing, value growth. But I always knew I wanted to be a growth investor because of that IBD background. And then, you know, as soon as I reached what I thought was the mountaintop, of course, there was a merger. BNY and Mellon merged. And our fund was shut down. And then I had to go back to the sell side for 3.5 years. And then luckily, I was introduced to Tom O'Halloran. And I still remember the meeting like it was yesterday. We went to lunch in Midtown. Within 5 minutes, IBD came up. Charts came up. Like you said, Dave, he goes through charts like crazy. And so do I. And then I thought, wow, I finally met someone that's on the same level as in terms of my passion for combining fundamentals and technicals. And he too, like, learned, you know, he was a lawyer and then he kind of dropped out of, or I don't think he dropped out. He finished and became a prosecutor. So he did a little bit better than I did in terms of his study. And so but when he went back to business school and started his career, he tells the story better than I do, but he went to school with Stan Druckenmiller, and then he ended up looking up Stan Druckenmiller and found out that he used to use technical analysis. And then Tom happened on to Investor's Business Daily and has been a reader ever since as well. So we both had this similar background, you know, and just that created such a camaraderie from the beginning. And then luckily he hired me, and now I have the pleasure of working full time, 100% of my time dedicated to technical analysis for our 5 strategies at Lord Abbett, which is just a dream come true. And I've been there, you know, 12 years now, I think, and I'm really blessed to be there.
Yeah, you know, thank you first of all for sharing that story in both personal levels and just all the humility and respect and everything else that you bring to the endeavor of personal growth and whatnot. I mean, I think, you know, there is a reason why we asked this question first. And, your answer to this question really highlights why we asked the question, because your story is incredible. It's, you know, it's full of happenstance and fortune and hard work and a lot of times just taking a chance. But, you know, ultimately it's, you know, we have a lot of listeners on this podcast and they run the gamut in ages and whatnot, but a lot of them are younger folks. Tyler and I get emails and we get pinged on social media all the time about a lot of the CMT charters. We just had a couple of them that just passed their CMT level 3 that were inspired by the stories they heard on this podcast. And so this is why we asked this question. So thanks for giving us that really personal answer, and hopefully it inspired still more people as we move forward. But so I don't know if we should start talking first about working with Tom, or if we should maybe cover how you think about technicals first, and then let's start there. Let's talk about your process. What things do you the great strength of technicals is there are a lot of tools, but it's also one of the weaknesses. There are a lot of tools. So what have you settled on, and what makes you a better input in the fundamental community for guys that are using fundamentals to manage portfolios, but are also leaning on technicals? How have you narrowed down that toolkit to help a fundamental manager?
Yeah, Dave. And it's like you said, there's a lot of indicators. And you know, as well as I do, that's probably at least a decade of, I think, your career when you start technicals is just sifting through all the different types of indicators. There's so many exciting ones. But to your point, there's also so many that it's overwhelming. And, you know, it's funny because I just kept reading and reading and reading, and every book or every person that I would read about had just such a brilliant strategy. I was like, oh, I want to try that one. And then I would take a little bit from that strategy. And then I said, oh, that one sounds good. It's kind of, it was almost like, you know, the self-help book spiral at times, you know. You know what I'm talking about there.
You get
kind of pumped up, and I've never been to a Tony Robbins seminar, but I could imagine the energy in the room, and you come back and you're like, yes, I'm going to conquer the world, and you start using it, and then, you know, 6 months down the road, you're like, oh, maybe I need a new strategy. I'm getting a little bored of that one. Yeah. But it wasn't like that for me in technicals. I was just so excited but it was a little bit overwhelming, all the different indicators and such. Right. And by the way, I didn't know about the CMT, nor did I know about the CFA quite honestly, for several years when I started, because I, like I said, I came from humble beginnings and didn't know a lot about Wall Street, and I changed careers. And I quickly learned about the CFA. And, you know, that was like kind of the gold standard. But and when I first heard about the CMT, as a lot of folks have mentioned, it was not in the greatest light, which I found kind of strange. But anyway, diversion there. But, you know, but now when I'm looking at how did I bring all those things together and form a process that was of my own, that was a lot of trial and error. And it was a lot of discovery of my own psychology and risk tolerance. Right. And, you know, I heard John Bollinger, and I know you guys will do a better job of paraphrasing this than I will, but he talks a lot about the foundations. I don't know if that's the exact term. Is that the foundations?
First principles.
I knew you guys would do a better job. So the first principles of in technical analysis. And that really resonated with me. And that's where I was kind of going towards. Like, so there was these price, volume, trend, those sort of things. And then narrowing down the indicators you use within each of those buckets. So what I kind of do now is I've created what I've called a momentum scorecard, and that's updated every day, but it goes to the team once a week. And so what I'd start with first is the market trend. And I pull from a few different things, but two of the main things that I pull from IBD, once again, what's Investor's Business Daily saying about the general market trend?
Interesting. Wow.
And and they have three categories: uptrend, confirmed uptrend. That's the first.
Which we're in now, by the way, right?
Thank God. It's nice to see.
Finally.
and then they go to uptrend under pressure. And that's if the distribution days, which is another key component of theirs, if those start to add up, they put the uptrend under pressure. And then they have a downtrend. I like things simple. three different buckets. So that's the first thing that I look at. And then I look at the general Russell 3000. What is that price doing in relation to the 150-day moving average? Which, if folks have heard me talk about that, I got that from Carter Worth, so who has his own firm now. And he's great. We go back a long time. He uses the 150-day moving average. I came to use that over time talking to him. And so I look at the price of the Russell 3000 and every index, but I use that one mainly and see if it's above the 150-day moving average. And also importantly, whether that 150-day moving average is sloping upward, sideways, or downward. Right now, we have the price above the 150-day moving average, but the slope is still kind of negative, but it's starting to flatten out for the first time in a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So that one is kind of like, you know, it's the trend, the market trend is pretty bullish right now, I would say, with that one slight caveat of the slope is still not quite yet pointed up. Mm-hmm. So next, I look at the market breadth, and I define that a little bit differently. That's one of those terms that are indicators that can be defined in many different ways. And by the way, just because I define something doesn't mean it's the best, okay? Like, please, like, I just came to this conclusion by trial and error and what works best for me. So there's so many great ways and methods out there to do this. And this is not, by far, not the best one. There's, you know, but this is the way we're doing it. So first, look at the market trend.
You know, we Tyler and I talk about that a lot with guests on the podcast, where it's, there's a lot of things that actually can be of great value to any investor that comes from the technical toolkit. And a lot of, we can backtest a lot of it, and most of it works. Most of it does just fine. But what's more important than all, so therefore what's more important than finding something that works is finding something that works for you. Because at the end of the day, you have to drive the bus. And if you don't know how to drive the bus and you're not comfortable in that behind that steering wheel, even if it's a good process, you're going to still lose money. So don't feel apologetic that you know, this is your style, because that's what actually, the fact that that is your style is what's more important. The fact that this is how you have discovered that it works best for you. So,
and Vern, if you wouldn't mind, for our listeners, why 150 days rather than a 200-day moving average?
Sure. Yeah. So the 150-day moving average, like I said, was brought to me, my attention, by Carter Worth. And before that, I was using the 50-day and the 200-day. Those are pretty much the most popular ones on the planet. And I was looking at them when they crossed over, and I'll get to this a little bit later, but I was always a collector of like baseball cards. I loved playing baseball when I was growing up. I love playing basketball. I love collecting the cards, and I love the order of putting them, like just organizing them. And it just, I don't know why, I'm just, it made me almost like OCD. And so when I looked at this huge number of stocks, I'm like, God, I got to get these things into categories first. That's, I don't know why. I just thought of, when I saw charts, I instantly saw kind of a sine wave in the moving average, and I saw a price, and I saw slopes of those moving averages. And I thought to myself, I can make an objective category, I think, out of these. So I started testing, and I saw this, I think it was Stan Weinstein's book that kind of gave me the idea. And I don't know if you've ever read that book. It's, maybe it's not as mentioned as much, but he talked about different stages of a stock's life cycle.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I love that. I love the fact that, oh, maybe I can get an earlier uptrend and see it grow up. And mm-hmm. and so I was using the 50-day and the 200-day in relationship to price to, you know, see if I could come up with categories. And I did that, but it became right. just kind of cumbersome. Mm-hmm. And then Butterworth came into my office and said, here's the 150-day moving average. I've done a lot of tests on this. A lot of important people have done a lot of tests on this. And so, sure. and he's just such a great person, you know. So I started looking at that and said, you know, this makes things simple. I had six categories before. If I use the 150-day moving average and price, that could allow me to get it down to four categories, which I'll discuss in a few minutes. And then Ben Abel on my team once pointed out, he said, you know, this aligns nicely with the fundamentals too. It's yep. about a little over two quarters of data, 150 trading days. Mm-hmm. And it really sums up if there's a trend, not only in price, but in the fundamentals, if there's something going on fundamentally, two quarters to three quarters kind of make a trend, right? And so I thought that was an interesting tie-in on the fundamental side as well from Ben. And so it just kind of stuck. And I felt like it was a Goldilocks type of approach as well. Like the 50-day was a little too short and had a lot of signals. And the 200-day was a little too long. And by the time it got down there, you know, it was you lost a little bit more money. So the 150, I felt like was, again, it kind of fit with my psychology, if you will. Right. Like I just felt comfortable using it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Love it.
So back to that scorecard real quick. The first thing we look at is the market trend, which talked about. The second thing is the market breadth. And we define that, kind of got off on a tangent with the indicators and things.
Good, like
that. But the second thing we look for is the market breadth. And we define that as a percentage of stocks in the Russell 3000, the core index, over the 150-day. And Ari Wald over at Oppenheimer did a similar study, but he looks at the stocks above the 200-day moving average, I believe, in the NYSE. And he did a lot of back testing, like you were mentioning, Dave. That's one of the beauties of a lot of the new curriculum in the yeah. CMT is the rigorous studies that are going on. It's very exciting. But he did a lot of studies on that back testing and seeing how many, like looking at the ranges of stocks and the percentage ranges of stocks, how that related to forward returns. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, anything kind of over 60 or 70%, meaning there's of the Russell 3000, or in his case, NYSE, the percentage of stocks, if there's 60 or 70% of those stocks are above a moving average, it's great for forward 1 year returns. Mm-hmm. And then there was a contrarian component, which I also like. If the stocks fall below 20%, meaning the total number of stocks in that index, only 20% or less are above the moving average, it's really, really good contrarian indicator. And that's what we saw last summer. So just a side note, that I think that's one of the reason I really liked using this. So yeah, that's something we monitor right now. I think we're around 61, 62. So we're getting right on the cusp. Like that hasn't happened, by the way, since 2021. Mm-hmm. And so right now we find ourselves in a good market trend. We mm-hmm. find ourselves with good market breadth. The third thing is kind of momentum indicators. The one I think point to is the monthly MACD on the general broad index, the Russell 3000. When those two things cross, it's pretty powerful. If you go back and look at that, you'll see that it hasn't happened that many times, so there's not a lot of signals. And it's been pretty good at getting you out of the way of big drawdowns, especially if they're very rounded. They're not as good yeah. in sharp corrections, V recoveries. Yeah. And so, but you know, so sometimes it gets you in and out a little too quick. But I kind of use the monthly MACD and a few other momentum indicators to just see what's going on there. But I will say, I think those are the most lagging indicators of they lag. So right now we're in a, I feel like we're kind of in a neutral position in our momentum indicators. So that's the only one that hasn't flipped green. And then the last thing we do is that we look at the technical health of our watch list, and we break that up, all of our watch lists, just meaning that we've vetted out of the Russell 3000, say, I think it's about 1,000 names right now that we, you know, our analysts and experts know very well. And we keep that on a very, very tightly, you know, like we watch that very closely every day. So, and then we break each one of those stocks up into one of our four categories of technical health. And those four categories, by the way, just the names are uptrend, pullback, snapback, and downtrend. And I can get into that a little bit more here shortly. But right now, I think it's something closing in on 70% of that watch list, which is an elite group of names. 70% of those are either in a uptrend or a snapback, and those are our two bullish categories. So we've got like a lot of positive signals for the first time in several years, especially in growth. We have all these stocks that are bottoming out and have solid growth or solid chart patterns of basing patterns, meaning the 150 day is flattening. They've gone sideways for quite a bit of time, and they're starting to emerge up through the 150 day moving average in what Carter would call bearish to bullish reversals. So we haven't seen that in a while, which has us excited. And what you know today is, I think, is today the Fed, by the way. So maybe by the time this comes out, I will have reversed all the statements. And that's what, but that's where to the last point here to make is that's where the technicals are great. And it really is additive to a fundamental process, is because you can adapt day to day to changing information. And and it's very hard to do that sometimes with fundamentals because you don't get as many data points as you do with the price chart. The price chart has a data point every single day, every single trading day, and it's telling you what the fundamental analysts are feeling, thinking, scared of, you know, whatever that may be. And so, you know, to be able to use technical analysis with fundamentals is just, it just makes sense to me because it adds a layer of protection.
Vern, you mentioned taking 1,000 names in the Russell 3000. What are you using to screen out or eliminate the bottom two thirds? Is that on fundamental factors or just things that are more fitting to the mandate of your five funds?
I would say it's a little bit of both, Tyler. You know, the reason I look at the Russell 3000, we have a growth mandate. But the reason I look at the Russell 3000 is sometimes things sneak in there or they get miscategorized by the index makers. Nothing against them, of course, but you know, say an IPO comes into the mix and they don't really have a lot of data, that they might not know how to categorize it. So they just use simple screening, not simple, but you know, different screening mechanisms that put it into either a value or growth index. So I take a very broad view of the world, but the fundamental analyst, they kind of know right away what is a growth company and what is not. And then I keep an eye on them just in case. With, we also have, you know, kind of ranking systems, not only technically, but fundamentally, internally, proprietary ranking systems that we've developed and the fundamental experts have developed to also show things that are popping up on their screens. But it's not really we're not a quant fund, right? We're not quant driven. We just use that as a tool, but we do use quant as a tool to help us monitor that broad index to see what goes on the watch list. And it changes, but not a ton.
You know, one of the things I noticed recently, I was doing this work last week, I think it was, and I noticed that if you look at the standard growth ETFs, it probably wouldn't surprise most people that, you know, somewhere between 30 to 40 or 50% of a particular growth ETF might be in technology or biotech or media or something like that. And maybe, you know, 1 or 2% of it, of the ETF might be in energy. But then if you actually look at the fundamentals, the recent fundamentals of these companies, and you just kind of bucket the fundamental qualifications into their sort of like top line revenue growth. And let's say you create a revenue bucket of at least 50% revenue growth. And you just take all the 3,000 stocks and kind of put them in their revenue growth buckets. And then you look at what's in the 50% top line revenue growth bucket. It's like 40% of its energy. You know, so but there's no energy in the growth ETF. So that's where I think is oftentimes the opportunity for if you're really trying to beat a benchmark is to really focus in on what's actually growing versus what's for some reason is or is not in some growth benchmark when it's like there's a delay to the fundamental data that they before they actually take things in out and put things into the new ETFs.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Dave.
CMT level 3 question on the narrative fallacy, Dave. You just outlined it for everybody, right?
The story, I knew I was doing that.
The story of growth stocks doesn't typically look at railroads and energy and mining and minerals. But if you just look at the facts, that's where we're ending up. That's
fantastic. It's a very important point. And, you know, everything, you know, it's either absolute or relative, right, in our world. Yep. And that's especially true, Dave, when, you know, say there's a multiple compression going on in growth stocks like we've experienced. And they might on paper show high sales revenue growth, but that might be stagnating or declining a touch. So it's going, say, from 50 to 45%. That direction is important on a relative basis, whereas the energy was going from, maybe it was going from 10 to 15 or 20. So is that momentum? I would argue yes. And that's what we do. That's why what we do, I think, is important. And why we might have an edge, a slight edge, but I'm biased, of course, is because we look at both. We look at first operating momentum. We have this process where we have three bubbles, right? We're trying to find market leaders in our first bubble, disruptors, innovators, whatever you want to call them, but market leaders. And then we want to see that they have fundamental or operating momentum. Is that are their fundamentals getting better on an absolute and relative basis? And then we look at price momentum. Do they have positive price momentum? And where is that in the cycle? And when those three circles overlap, that's where we think the magic occurs. And then that's more or less our humble process, but we think it's very powerful because if you know better than anyone, Dave, you've been doing this a long time as well. Like there's few of us that are combining fundamentals and technicals. And I'm always perplexed by that. I'm like, why wouldn't you use the tools? This is a gift.
So that's the whole purpose of the podcast, right? That's why we called it Fill the Gap, because there's a large sort of gap, if you will, in the understanding of markets for most portfolio managers. And it's because they don't understand, they don't appreciate the value that can be added vis-a-vis technicals. And you know, technicals can fill the gap for a lot of portfolio managers. I've said it several times on this podcast where I've seen some really good stock pickers become phenomenal portfolio managers when they started to lean on technicals to help them with risk management, position sizing, you know, when to exit a position, idea sourcing, new you know, generating new ideas. Because you had mentioned earlier that the technicals change daily, and so you can watch them daily, but fundamentals don't really change daily. But the truth is, at least this is in my humble opinion, is that the market absorbs billions of fundamental data points every day. It's just that we can only process so many. So we therefore might categorize it as being a slow moving data set. But the reality is there's billions of fundamental data points hitting the market every day. And that's why the market's the best fundamental analyst on the planet, because it's the only mechanism that can absorb all that data, make sense of it, scrap what doesn't matter, emphasize what does, and then let all that be reflected vis-a-vis trend. And that's why we as technicians, I mean, if we're doing our job, we've basically hired the market to be our fundamental analyst, and we just listen as best we can.
That's very well said.
You made that comment earlier. We sort of glossed over it, which was that you didn't know about CFA or CMT. And then when you came to know about them, this is years ago, there was some, you know, disparaging commentary or mentors leading you away from using technical analysis. Do you care to touch on that at all? What was your experience?
Sure. I'll try not to offend anyone. But, you know, it was hard. I'm not going to lie. This was a very hard road. It felt very lonely at times. I think today there's a lot of great technicians on the street and sell side, and it's become a lot better actually, and mainly from the work that you all are doing, I believe. And reaching out to the CFA. You know, this is it was almost like religious warfare, or and it still is in a lot of people's eyes. I'm just shocked at the vitriol, or like how mad people get when they hear technicals. Like they get offended. Like I'm like, wow, man, just slow down, calm down. It's not that bad. It's just charts. I mean, your doctor shows you charts when you go to the heart doctor, you know. And it's like, and I can tell you right now, you're in tachycardia. This thing is, you know. And so it was very tough. They, you know, you'd get called strange words, witch doctor, voodoo doctor, snake charmer, you know, what are you going to do next? Look at the stars, you know. And I
well,
never
it's like
really
when you had... when your position, you can't defend your position. That's what you do. You lash out and start calling people names, and you get abusive, and you try to distract from the fact that, you know, that thing that you're following with trends and technicals, that thing that you're trying to interpret, you know, beats me almost every year because I can't keep up with my benchmark. And it angers me that you can assist somebody to keep up with the benchmark by just doing simple things like trend following and momentum analysis. And that's, if you're, you know, this is an ego-based business and there's a lot of type A personalities, and it's very difficult to just let go of that and just check your ego at the door and admit that the market knows more than you do. It's not like we as technicians are telling the fundamental community that we know more than you. That's not what we're saying. We're just willing to admit that the market knows more than us. And here's some tools that you can use to help you better align yourself with what the market's saying. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the only way you're ever going to make money is if you're aligned with what the market's saying. Find me a person who made money in a stock going down.
That's right. That's right.
Look, I can wait. We have time. You know.
I know. That, Tyler, he got us all fired up now. I
yeah.
He has a tendency to do that.
You know, this is, I know he was baiting us. I know, Dave.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, this it's very important to have, you know, think of this. Technicals are not only for helping generate returns, but I think the most important part of technicals is managing risk. Like if you break a trend line, it's usually when the stock is at its best fundamentally, you know, and or the market's going down and it's not discriminating against what stock's the best. So it's really a good form of protection, I find, in terms of helping keep you out of really big drawdowns. But, you know, I think what happened over time, and I wish I would have discovered earlier, was, you know, the CMT organization. I think at first I was discouraged from taking that exam. Now you're not. Like we have a young person on our team, Eugene Feldman, who has a CFA and CMT. When he came to me and asked about it, I was like, yeah, absolutely take it. Mm-hmm. And he went of course, Tom's going to say, yes, take it. And the rest of the firm was saying that now. It's really, you guys have really done a great job of strengthening, I guess, the brand. I don't like to use that term, but, mm-hmm. you know, I think the craft of technical analysis, you guys have really done a lot. And when I did discover and finally take the CMT, I think I passed in 2016. I took it very late. It was during a very bad bear market in 15 and 16, and I needed it.
Yeah.
It really helped my process and honed the process. And more importantly, it got me into a community. Mm-hmm. And that community has been phenomenal. I can't thank you all enough. You've given me so many great opportunities to speak in front of everyone at the symposium. I remember I was shaking like a leaf, and Tyler asked me to do it. I was like, I'm not the best public speaker. It wasn't my strong suit. But I had so much support from everyone there, from legends too. I'm like, Louise Yamada was right in the front row, just, you know, supporting me. Craig Johnson, before I spoke, came up to me and patted me on the back and said, you got this. You know, I met lifelong friends. The person that spoke before me, Arusha Pierce from Investors Business Daily, spoke right before me. Invited me this year to speak to Investors Business Daily in Las Vegas. What a dream come true. I would have never have pictured that happening as a young kid, you know, driving around in a junky produce van in Huntington, West Virginia. You know, like, what a great life this is, you know, and I have you all to thank for many of those great experiences.
Yeah. Vern, when you say you guys, I just want our listeners to know, you're not talking about Dave and I. The organization is now 50 years old. And when I talk to undergrads who are in our academic partner program, they're learning technical analysis in a way that was never available when I was in business school. They don't even understand that there was reticence or distrust of technical analysis. And if you talk to the founders of the organization who are trying to bring some professionalism and stand up for technical analysts in the late 60s, I mean, they were laughed out of rooms and kicked out of clubs. And I mean, definitely second-class citizens on Wall Street. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that people don't know exactly what responsible professional technical analysis is all about. So I think as a segue, let's go back to your process and tools, because you were explaining what was both a top-down and a bottom-up approach. It's just sensible, logical, and repeatable. And I think that that's largely what the industry misses about technical analysis. Right? It's not just short term. It's not reading tea leaves. It's all based in science, and you can backtest it. So let's talk a little bit about those five funds and about your process.
Yeah, sure. And I think you hit the nail on the head. The curriculum had a book by David Aronson, Evidence-Based mm-hmm. Technical Analysis.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, great book.
It's just such a great book. And I think that's exactly the type of thing, Tyler, that you're speaking about that's pushing us over the line. I would almost argue that some of the quant departments around Wall Street just kind of hijacked technical analysis, but I'm biased. And not our quant team, of course. We work very closely together.
Yeah.
But that in and of itself is a huge change. Like at Lord Abbett, I work with the quant team, backtesting a lot of our methods. And they bring to the table such expertise that I didn't have, but it was what was kind of in the book, Evidence-Based Technical Analysis by David Aronson. So I'm fortunate to have that group of folks helping me out. And when we developed this process, we were based, first, let's take a step back. We were practitioners. We didn't come at this from an academic standpoint. We were practicing. We were standing on the shoulders of giants, as you all like to say. I had mentors from afar, like Bill O'Neill, that I never met, but read about and just took pieces of their process and put it together and made it my own. Mm-hmm. I've worked with my team members to get their advice and input. So many people go into building this process and having it evolve. But now we have these kind of four categories, main categories that I talked about: uptrend, pullback, snapback, and downtrend. And we kept it simple. What's the price in relation to the 150-day moving average? And what's the slope of that 150-day moving average? So quick definition. An uptrend is when the price is above the 150-day moving average. And that 150-day moving average today is greater than it was 2 months ago, meaning the slope is positive. That's what we call an uptrend. If that price were to fall below the upward sloping 150-day moving average, we call that a pullback. If then the pullback continues to weaken, 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 and it brings down the slope of that 150-day moving average. So now you have the price below a downward sloping 150-day moving average, meaning the price of the 150-day moving average today is less than it was 2 months ago. We call that a downtrend. And then we wait to see if that price can go back up through that downward sloping moving average. If it does, the price is now above the 150-day moving average that's still sloped down. We call that a snapback. And then we wait to see if it can graduate back into an uptrend, and that's how it goes. So it's a circle. It's like a cycle of a stock. And that's coming more or less from Stan Weinstein. I love the way he showed that. I'd highly recommend looking at that book if you want to understand a little bit more about my psychology. Maybe you don't want to read about it.
Can I just, before you go on, I want to highlight something to our listeners that what you just described is a first principle. It's like what I would refer to as inviolable rules of trend following. So if you ever look at Tesla's chart during the period that it had when it was running higher, it was in an uptrend by your definition. So it's that simple. Now, there are other elements that you can introduce, like relative performance and volatility and everything else, particularly as it relates to position sizing. But it really is that simple. So to the extent that as you're building out a technical process that they can help inform your fundamental process, to the extent that you're finding it, you know, more difficult than that, it's because you have stuff going on in your head that you feel you need to do more than that. And so it the whole point is to accept that it's that simple. Stocks can't go up a lot unless it's in an uptrend. Don't complicate that, right? If you want to get real complex, then get real complex on your fundamental stuff, right? That's fine. But technicals, it's just the best framework to start with. And if you have everything in your portfolio that's in an uptrend, you should be doing well.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And as we say in the South, can I get an amen over there, Talia?
Amen.
So the four categories give you more of an objective. They're more objective than some of the subjective patterns that may be out there, like the head and shoulders and that sort of thing, which work, by the way. A lot of those have been tested in things. But the objective patterns with these four categories was another big way of just not fighting the market. As Dave mentioned earlier, we do not want to fight the market. The market is always right. But it's also a way to let our winners run and cut our losers quickly. So, you know, in your example that you used, if we're looking at something that's above an upward sloping line in an uptrend, why worry about it? We may look at relative strength and that sort of thing, but I found that absolute momentum, which is not as talked about as much as relative momentum. Relative momentum is what you see in the momentum academic research. And I've talked a lot about that in the past, so I won't go down that rabbit hole. But I really like absolute momentum, and we are trend followers. We are momentum investors. That's one way to make money. You can make money being a mean reversion trader. There's lots of different ways to make money. It just so happens that it aligns with my personality. And to your point, Dave, if you're a more short-term or long-term investor, you can use different moving averages. You can come up with different categories. So what those four patterns do is that it allows you to take some of the emotion and ego out of the equation, I think, a little bit. So, you know, for instance, if I'm going into the office now of an analyst that is really an expert of their field, I can ask them what's going on fundamentally. Is there's something happening on the operating momentum side or the fundamental side that's making the chart go down? And if it is, if there's something going on fundamentally and the chart is starting to deteriorate, say we go from an uptrend to a pullback, that's an easy sell. We'll just sell it. It will at least trim it, if not exit it altogether. But what also happens with these different patterns is, and I find interesting, is that it really starts the conversation. I think that that's an important thing for the folks that may not still believe in the technicals and what it can do. If they're still not convinced that, one, there's tons of academic research out there that proves that it works, two, that there's plenty of people that have proven that it's worked in real time, you know, for long, long periods of time and have been very successful at it. Three, at least, and if three, they don't believe in the risk management potential of it, which I think is crucial and huge, maybe the most important part of technical analysis, at least they can buy into the fact that it starts a conversation. And by the way, that just brings me to how many times, Dave and Tyler, I just need to get this off my chest, I guess, too. One more thing, and then we'll get back to this. How many times have you talked to a pure fundamental analyst or someone about a stock, and the first thing they do is punch it into Bloomberg?
Pull up the chart.
You look at the chart. Well,
yeah. What are you doing? What if you don't believe in that? Save yourself $30,000 or whatever it costs. Get rid of Bloomberg. Save another $30,000. Get rid of FactSet and just get rid of the charts. Like, but and then what do they always say? I can't buy it. It's already run. Wait a minute. You know. So it's that was my little rant. Okay. But again, I love all my fundamental brothers and sisters out there. I think we're all one big family, and I think we're doing that right now with Fill the Gap and. And so, but what these four categories I found really helpful in doing is starting the conversation. So in our team meetings, I can bring in the watch list. It's all categorized. I show what has changed over the past week, meaning what has shifted into a new category from, say, like a downtrend to a snapback. And by the way, that's what we started seeing late last year, was a lot of increases in new snapbacks and new uptrends. And that starts the conversation. Hey, we haven't looked at this chart in a very, very long time. I know you were mentioning the fundamentals. I know that you saw them at a conference and you liked what you heard. It just went into a snapback. We should discuss starting a position in this now. And it's really like every day this conversation can be had, and it's fun. It makes it a lot of fun. You can take a step back. This is one of the funnest professions in the world, we get to do. And it's also one of the most serious professions in the world, that people entrust us with their money. What a gift. that our clients say to us, here's our money. Can you help us with our retirement? That's such a pleasure to be able to do that. And it's serious. And so having a process that's consistent and repeatable, like you said, Tyler, is crucial to alert us for when we might be getting off track. That's why having this type of process is crucial. If we fail in our psychology, which is a huge component of investing, is psychology, human emotions, ego, behavioral finance. They don't you can't teach that until you push the buy and sell buttons. You can't learn that until you've been under the pressure. There's an enormous amount of pressure. On paper, you read about it in a book. Investing is very straightforward. Even mm-hmm. though it's very complex, it's pretty straightforward. But right. you don't know how it's going to affect you emotionally until you get into the game. And my God, we've all been through the ringer, right? Where you think you're a genius and then you're a failure, you're a fraud, you're a genius, you're a failure. And technicals, I have to say, that's what helped me help protect me from those wild swings. Because if it's a pullback, it's what the market says and the market's always right. If it's a downtrend, that's what the market says and the market's always right. And so it takes a lot of that pressure off there in that form as well, in terms of the emotional side.
I love that. Again, we've got all different kinds of people listening to the podcast. We have aspiring technicians trying to figure out how to enjoin what we've learned with the fundamental community to help them. But we also have fundamental managers who are just trying to learn about it and figure out how they might be able to incorporate it. And I can only say that, having done both myself, but also advise, like you do, Vern, advise portfolio managers on the value of technicals. The greatest use that I've seen of technicals by fundamental managers is when they're already kind of starting to feel like there might be a negative inflection in the fundamentals. And I come into their office as part of my monthly portfolio review and say, these are the charts that I would be looking at as you said, Vern, you could not have said it better. Conversation starters. Start talking about this stock on your team, because the market's saying there's in a long enough time frame, driven by fundamentals, that time frame of trend is changing. Talk about this stock. It helps the team prioritize their very limited resource of time. Mm-hmm. And so it drives conversations about the things they should be talking about. And over my years, I've just seen the best confluence of inputs or the best decisions were made when it was both price and fundamentals come together to make a decision. Those are the best value-added alpha-generating decisions, both on the upside and the downside. And you just brought that whole concept to life as yourself doing it live with Tom over at Lord Abbott. I mean, it's perfect. That's what this conversation is all about.
That's great. And yeah, I get carried away with the technicals because that's what I do full-time. But that's just a very small component of our process. You know, The real work is done by the experts on the fundamental side. I like to say, you know, they work so hard and it's easy. You know, I was a junior financial or fundamental analyst too, believe it or not. And back at Bank of New York, I covered financials and that was boring. I'll tell you, they weren't very many growth stocks and financials, but I did find the exchanges back then. And, you know, that was cool. But, and then of course, financials blew up. We all know what happened there. So figures.
Yeah.
But you know, like the enormous amount of time it takes and the expertise that they have is just so humbling. And to meet with the company, to spend hours and hours and hours reading research, building models, talking to experts in the industry, it's such an investment before you make the investment. So it's very, very easy to almost get attached to companies when you put that much work into it. And I think what the technicals can really help with is just take a little bit of a step back and say, you know, this company's really good, but how do I protect myself and my clients' money in case I was wrong, in case I was early, in case something I missed something? We're all human. And I think that's where technicals can really, really compliment the fundamental analysts. They're doing a lot of really tough work, and if they have just one more guardrail in the form of technicals to say, hey, if this thing goes into a pullback, maybe I can adjust the size, or maybe I'm a little early, I can just do a size. That's a huge benefit in my mind. I don't think these aren't mutually exclusive things at all. These are very complementary, fundamentals and technicals.
And the fact is, regardless of any of the work that we do, technical or fundamental, the market changes over time. right? Eastman Kodak is not the leading growth stock anymore. And so if you're so wed to the work that you did on Eastman Kodak, you're missing a huge piece.
But even worse than that, Tyler, is that like, as an example, Amazon was one of the leadership stocks into the 2000 peak, the bubble in 2000. Mm-hmm. That stock from the peak in 2000 to the bottom in 2002 went down 95%, I think it was. Mm-hmm. In that span of time, in that 2-year span of time, do you know what their revenues did?
Doubled.
They went up 95%. Yep. So it was still a growth stock.
Yep.
So as Ralph Acampora is very fond of saying, and he can't say it enough, is that there's a difference between a good stock in a good company, in a bad stock. What you're looking for is good company, good stock, because you can absolutely have a good company and it's a bad stock. And they could be, you know, the internet bubble after it peaked in 2000, that technology and growth underperformed until the global financial crisis bottom. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of great companies in there, but it didn't matter. What mattered then was energy, materials, industrials, home builders, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And that's where the best fundamentals were. How do we know that? Because that's what showed up in charts. Mm. Not tech.
So well said.
Vern, can you speak to the flexibility within the team? Just, you know, if you have a thesis on something and the market disagrees with you, how quickly can you make a decision to reverse what was the prevailing opinion on a name?
It doesn't happen very often, but if it's severe enough, intraday. If it's new, like you said, the beauty of this is that I think it's Andrew Lowe that said it, an adaptive market hypothesis. I believe that was in the curriculum, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, sir. You know. Yep.
Okay, good. It's still there. I that was a very influential piece from the CMT curriculum. And I think that that's what it's so fantastic. And so I think that that's kind of what we're talking about a lot here today, right? Is that ability to adapt to new information, whether it be fundamental or technicals. So I think that's the beauty of combining the two, is having that flexibility. But in my case, I think that's where Tom O'Halloran really, really shines. Just he's done so much for me, and I've learned so much from him. It would take another podcast to just talk about Tom. And I'm sure he'll be on this podcast and do a hell of a lot better job of talking about his background than I will. But just to be, you know, under his wing and see how he could in one setting have a view on a stock and be persuaded by the fundamentals and or the technicals to change his mind in the next second. Mm-hmm. To have that flexibility and the humility that goes along with that flexibility, they're kind of go hand in hand, don't they? Humility and flexibility.
Yes.
And
100%.
Shying away from taking risk. Those are very hard things to put together, you know? And I think that's where the process, once again, I know I'm harping on this, but that's where trusting your process really helps you, because why shouldn't you adjust to new information? That's the game. That's what we do. If something new happens, we adjust to that information. And so Tom is a master at that. I'm very fortunate to have learned under, you know, been under his wing when it comes to that.
Yeah.
Well said. Vern, as we're coming to the end of this interview, it's February 1st. We've got the first month of the year in. Are there aspects of either cross asset analysis or breadth or sectors that you're looking at in terms of new opportunities and a new leadership group sort of taking shape in this market?
Yeah, I think like I was speaking about earlier, and it's a good segue because, as you know, by the time this comes out, I might have already changed opinions, of course. Yes. So, but as it stands today, you know, the market trend is positive. IBD is in a confirmed uptrend. We got the price above the moving averages. Those moving averages are flattening out. We got market breadth is expanding. We got more leading, more areas of the market participating, as opposed to last year where it was more narrow. Our momentum indicators are neutral, but looking like they're starting to lean towards the positive side. The watch list, we have a lot of uptrends and snapbacks, a lot of stocks emerging from solid patterns. that hasn't happened for a while. You know, before that, there were a lot of stocks that were running up into a downward sloping moving average, which that has less odds in my mind, as opposed to stocks that are breaking above a flattening moving average that's gone sideways for 6 months or so. There's plenty of stocks doing that. And where we're seeing it happen is, for the first time in a few years, is in some of our core areas in growth, whether that be in tech, consumer, parts of healthcare, but industrials are doing very well. There, a lot of those are making new highs. Those have been leadership that might carry over. Energy is kind of trying to decide, I feel like, what that's going to do. That was a huge leader. And now it's, you know, some are finding support, but some are breaking. So I'm not sure about that. But what's also interesting is that a lot of the, you know, quote, defensive areas like staples and utilities, they're rolling over. You know, they've, you know, even areas of healthcare, I feel like healthcare is kind of two separate categories. Yeah. There's a defensive side and an offensive side. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the biotechs started moving, I felt like, a lot earlier. I was speaking with Samantha Shevins, who covers biotech for us, a lot last year about the charts looking better. And those seem to be earlier in the move. But then you contrast that with things like like some of the managed care stocks. Those might be on, you know, have completed their job and might be taking a breather and rolling over a bit. So, you know, even some of the innovation ETFs and that sort of thing, they're starting to try to get above moving averages, still quite not, maybe not fully in uptrends, but starting to emerge. So I think there's a lot to be excited about. Growth was in a very bad bear market for 2 years. It really started in February. It really started probably in November of 2020 with the vaccine, but it really accelerated in February of 21. Growth just got hammered. And now it's like everyone's focused on the mega caps. And that's, interestingly, if you look at an equal weighted index of the S&P, it looks like it's breaking a downtrend very, very well. But the weight of those mega caps are pulling down the market cap weighted S&P. So it might not look as good. So the mega caps look like they might be taking a breather a little bit and giving ways to some smaller cap names. So there's a lot of merchandise all of a sudden in the past 3 months or so, especially in the last month or two, that are, we feel like it's offering up a good buy point.
And you can imagine, so if you're on a fundamentally minded team and that is really struggling with the notion that maybe we have a recession coming and that the Fed's not done raising rates, and we have all these things that are built, that where we build narratives around these things that we just don't know. Like, these are questions we can't answer. So we actually shouldn't be asking ourselves these questions because we don't know, but we do it anyway. And so now we've built this narrative, and then in the room comes the technician with a bunch of charts saying, hey, things are getting a lot better. This hasn't looked this good in 2 years. And you're scratching your head going, that's impossible. We have a recession coming. Mm-hmm. But to your point, Vern, I can imagine the conversations that a technician can really engender on a team, particularly when the evidence is starting to build in the opposite direction of the accepted narrative.
Yeah. And, you know, we could be wrong. We've seen several bad bear market rallies, and, you know, we've lived through them, right, Dave? Like in 2000, 2003, I think, were some of the worst, and it was a long period of time. And so, you know, we're cognizant of that. We're making sure we see the fundamentals, of course, the technicals. And that's where I think sizing can come into play. You know, we don't have to go all in right away when we start seeing those emerging signs. We can maybe take half positions and then see how it develops. If they start graduating from those snapbacks into uptrends, we can add a little bit more. So position sizing is important, I think, at the turn. But we just had this, you know, I guess you hear this term momentum crash a lot, and it sounds very scary. You know, momentum crash, and a lot of people mistakenly think it happens at the top of the market, and it doesn't. It happens usually at the turn after a correction. And when momentum really crashes is when the defensive stocks start to underperform on a relative basis and gives way to new leadership. And what was the past year's losers start to emerge and start to be potentially this year's or next year's winners. So that's kind of, I feel like, what we've just started to experience in December and January. where you saw a lot of former leaders of last year start to pull back and underperform, and what was really not doing so well last year has emerged and starting to win. And that big difference is just one more piece of evidence that you saw, like in March 2009 or even the beginning of March 2009 or 2003. So, you know, not all of those early movers are, you know, not all of the early movers are going to be future winners. So that's where the sizing comes into play. And also to look at it through the fundamental lens is so crucial to make sure that it's sustainable. And I feel like that's what we're doing right now. Before, we're just like, God, it was just a brutal few years. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You're always chasing your tail in those types of markets.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Sticking to process and sticking to your tools, particularly when times get tough, that it speaks volumes to you and your team, Vern, that you've made it through yet, or what could arguably be the end of another bear market cycle. We've talked a lot about the diversity of listeners to fill the gap. Vern, any final comments that you've got for all the candidates who are in the CMT program right now and potentially heading down that rabbit hole of adding a million different indicators to their charts and, you know, going whole hog on the learning?
You know, I would say just keep the passion alive, keep the belief alive. Don't lose the spark. Believe in yourselves. Just if you have this passion, if you, like I do, nothing can stop you from trying to get to where you want to be. Keep a very open mind. Stay flexible. Stay humble. And get into the game. Try it out. Be very, very comfortable with failure. Embrace failure. Embrace the struggle. That's where you learn the most. The bear markets, looking back on my career, the bear markets, a year in a bear market will teach you as much as 5 years in a bull market. There is just, you just got to be so comfortable with struggle and failure and know that that's when you're learning. And really, really embrace the community of the CMT. I wish I'd have done it a lot earlier. I'm glad I've done it since. When you feel like you may be the only one in the world looking at charts, just give one of us a call, you know, like go to one of the symposiums, get onto one of the webinars, find your community there, and you'll feel a lot more comfortable being who you are. But, you know, just don't give up on it. Have a lot of fun, too. This is one of the best things in the world that we get to do. And I find myself very privileged to do it and know folks like you all.
Oh, Vern, very well said. We are lucky to have you here on this episode 26 of Fill the Gap. Thank you so much for spending the afternoon with us. Looking forward to seeing you in April at the 50th anniversary CMT Symposium. And until then, be safe, be well, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Thanks, Tyler. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Vern. Great to see you.
Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima. In addition to candidate study of the official CMT curriculum, Optima provides a full video course on all of the material that candidates need to know for each level of the CMT exams. Each course is broken up into modules ranging from 15 to 45 minutes, depending on the complexity and length of the topics being covered. Learn more at Optima.com.